unable to sleep for fear of his good fortune. But now such sinister thoughts had come to an end. His uncanny guest was gone, and would never return again. Yet the riches remained, and were secure far into the future. Baldini laid a hand to his chest, and felt, beneath the cloth of his coat, that little book beside his beating heart. 600 formulas were recorded there, more than a whole generation of perfumers would ever be able to implement. If he were to lose everything today, he could, with just this wonderful little book, be a rich man once again within a year. Truly, he could not ask for more. From the gables of the houses across the way, the morning sun fell golden and warm on his face. Baldini was still looking to the south, down the street in the direction of the Palais de Parlement. It was simply too delightful not to see anything more of Grenouille, and, washed over by a sense of gratitude, he decided to make that pilgrimage to Notre-Dame today, to cast a gold coin in the alms box, to light 3 candles, and on his knees to thank his Lord for having heaped such good fortune on him, and having spared him from retribution. But then, that same afternoon, just as he was about to head for the church, something absurd happened. A rumour surfaced that the English had declared war on France. That was, of itself, hardly disquieting. But since Baldini had planned to send a shipment of perfume to London that very day, he postponed his visit to Notre-Dame, and instead went into the city to make inquiries, and from there to go out to his factory in the Faubourg Saint-Antoine, and cancel the shipment to London for the present. That night in bed, just before falling asleep, he had a brilliant idea. In light of the hostilities about to break out over the colonies in the New World, he would launch a perfume under the name of Prestige du Québec, a heroic, resinous scent whose success, this much was certain, would more than repay him for the loss of business with England. With that sweet thought in his silly old head, relieved and bedded now on its pillow, beneath which the pressure of the little book of formulas was pleasantly palpable, Maître Baldini fell asleep and awoke no more in this life. For that night a minor catastrophe occurred, which, with appropriate delays, resulted in a royal decree requiring that little by little all the buildings on all the bridges of Paris be torn down. For with no apparent reason, the west side of the Pont au Change, between the 3rd and 4th piers, collapsed. 2 buildings were hurtled into the river, so completely and suddenly that none of their occupants could be rescued. Fortunately, it was a matter of only 2 persons, to wit, Giuseppe Baldini and his wife, Teresa. The servants had gone out, either with or without permission. Chigny, who first returned home in the small hours slightly drunk, or rather intended to return home, since there was no home left, suffered a nervous breakdown. He had sacrificed 30 long years of his life, in hopes of being named heir in Baldini's will, for now the old man had neither children nor relatives. And now, at one blow, the entire inheritance was gone. Everything. House, business, raw materials, laboratory, Baldini himself. Indeed, even the will, which perhaps might have offered him a chance of becoming owner of the factory. Nothing was found. Not the bodies, not the safe, not the little books with their 600 formulas. Only one thing remained of Giuseppe Baldini, Europe's greatest perfumer. A very motley odour, of musk, cinnamon, vinegar, lavender, and 1,000 other things, that took several weeks to float high above the Seine from Paris to Le Havre. Part 2. 23. When the house of Giuseppe Baldini collapsed, Grenouille was already on the road to Orléans. He had left the enveloping haze of the city behind him, and with every step he took away from it, the air about him grew clearer, purer, and cleaner. It became thinner as well. Gone was the roiling of hundreds, thousands of changing odours at every pace. Instead, the few odours there were, of sandy road, meadows, the earth, plants, water, extended across the countryside in long currents, swelling slowly, abating slowly, with hardly an abrupt break. For Grenouille, this simplicity seemed a deliverance. The leisurely odours coaxed his nose. For the first time in his life, he did not have to prepare himself to catch the scent of something new, unexpected, hostile, or to lose a pleasant smell, with every breath. For the first time, he could almost breathe freely, did not constantly have to be on the olfactory lookout. We say almost, for of course nothing ever passed truly freely through Grenouille's nose. Even when there was not the least reason for it, he was always alert to, always wary of, everything that came from outside and had to be let inside. His whole life long, even in those few moments when he had experienced some inkling of satisfaction, contentment, and perhaps even happiness, he had preferred exhaling to inhaling, just as he had begun life not with a hopeful gasp for air, but with a blood-curdling scream. But except for that one proviso, which for him was simply a constitutional limitation, the farther Grenouille got from Paris, the better he felt, the more easily he breathed, the lighter his step, until he even managed sporadically to carry himself erect, so that when seen from a distance he looked almost like an ordinary itinerant journeyman, like a perfectly normal human being. Most liberating for him was the fact that other people were so far away. More people lived more densely packed in Paris than in any other city in the world. 600,000-700,000 people lived in Paris. Its streets and squares teemed with them, and the houses were crammed full of them from cellars to attics. There was hardly a corner of Paris that was not paralysed with people, not a stone, not a patch of earth that did not reek of humans. As he began to withdraw from them, it became clear to Grenouille for the first time that for 18 years their compacted human effluvium had oppressed him like air heavy with an imminent thunderstorm. Until now, he had thought that it was the world in general he wanted to squirm away from. But it was not the world, it was the people in it. You could live, so it seemed, in this world devoid of humanity. On the third day of his journey, he found himself under the influence of the olfactory gravity of Orléans. Long before any visible sign indicated that he was in the vicinity of a city, Grenouille sensed a condensation of human stuff in the air, and, reversing his original plan, decided to avoid Orléans. He did not want to have his newfound respiratory freedom ruined so soon by the sultry climate of humans. He circled the city in a giant arc, came upon the Loire at Châteauneuf, and crossed it at Sully. His sausage lasted that far. He bought himself a new one, and, leaving the river behind, pushed on to the interior. He now avoided not just cities, but villages as well. He was almost intoxicated by air that grew ever more rarefied, ever more devoid of humankind. He would approach a settlement or some isolated farm only to get new supplies, buying his bread and disappearing again into the woods. After a few weeks, even those few travellers he met on out-of-the-way paths proved too much for him. He could no longer bear the concentrated odour that appeared punctually with farmers out to mow the first hay on the meadows. He nervously skirted every herd of sheep, not because of the sheep, but to get away from the odour of the shepherds. He headed straight across country, and put up with mile-long detours whenever he caught the scent of a troop of riders still several hours distant. Not because, like other itinerant journeymen and vagabonds, he feared being stopped and asked for his papers, and then perhaps pressed into military service. He didn't even know there was a war on, but solely because he was disgusted by the human smell of the horsemen. And so it happened quite naturally, and as the result of no particular decision, that his plan to take the fastest road to Grasse gradually faded. The plan unravelled in freedom, so to speak, as did all his other plans and intentions. Grenouille no longer wanted to go somewhere, but only to go away, away from human beings. Finally, he travelled only by night. During the day, he crept into thickets, slept under bushes, in underbrush, in the most inaccessible spots, rolled up in a ball like an animal, his earthen-coloured horse blanket pulled up over his body and head, his nose wedged in the crook of an elbow, so that not the faintest foreign odour could disturb his dreams. He awoke at sunset, sniffed in all directions, and only when he could smell that the last farmer had left his fields and the most daring wanderer had sought shelter from the descending darkness, only when night and its presumed dangers had swept the countryside clean of people, did Grenouille creep out of hiding and set out again on his journey. He did not need light to see by. Even before, when he was travelling by day, he had often closed his eyes for hours on end and merely followed his nose. The gaudy landscape, the dazzling, abrupt definition of sight, hurt his eyes. He was delighted only by moonlight. Moonlight knew no colours and traced the contours of the terrain only very softly. It covered the land with a dirty grey, strangling life all night long. This world, moulded in lead, where nothing moved but the wind that fell sometimes like a shadow over the grey forests, and where nothing lived but the scent of the naked earth, was the only world that he accepted, for it was much like the world of his soul. He headed south, approximately south, for he did not steer by magnetic compass, but only by the compass of his nose, which sent him skirting every city, every village, every settlement. For weeks he met not a single person, and he might have been able to cradle himself in the soothing belief that he was alone in a world bathed in darkness or the cold light of the moon, had his delicate compass not taught him better. Humans existed by night as well, and there were humans in the most remote regions. They had only pulled back like rats into their lairs to sleep. The earth was not cleansed of them, for even in sleep they exuded their odour, which then forced its way out between the cracks of their dwellings and into the open air, poisoning a natural world only apparently left to its own devices. The more Grenouille had become accustomed to purer air, the more sensitive he was to human odour, which suddenly, quite unexpectedly, would come floating by in the night, ghastly as the stench of manure, betraying the presence of some shepherd's hut or charcoal burner's cottage or thieves' den. And then he would flee farther, increasingly sensitive to the increasingly infrequent smell of humankind. Thus his nose led him to ever more remote regions of the country, even farther from human beings, driving him on ever more insistently toward the magnetic pole of the greatest possible solitude. 24. That pole, the point of the kingdom most distant from humankind, was located in the Massif Central of the Auvergne, about 5 days' journey south of Clermont, on the peak of a 6,000-foot-high volcano named Plan du Cantal. The mountain consisted of a giant cone of blue-grey rock, and was surrounded by an endless, barren highland, studded with a few trees charred by fire, and overgrown with grey moss and grey brush, out of which, here and there, brown boulders jutted up like rotten teeth. Even by light of day, the region was so dismal and dreary that the poorest shepherd in this poverty-stricken province would not have driven his animals here. And by night, by the bleaching light of the moon, it was such a godforsaken wilderness that it seemed not of this world. Even Lebrun, the bandit of the Auvergne, though pursued from all sides, had preferred to fight his way through to the Cévennes and there be captured, drawn and quartered, rather than to hide out on the Plan du Cantal, where certainly no one would have sought or found him, but where likewise he would certainly have died a solitary, living death that had seemed to him worse still. For miles around the mountain there lived not one human being, nor even a respectable mammal, at best a few bats and a couple of beetles and adders. No one had scaled the peak for decades. Grenouille reached the mountain one August night in the year 1756. As dawn broke, he was standing on the peak. He did not yet know that his journey was at an end. He thought that this was only a stopping place on the way to ever purer air, and he turned full circle and let his nose move across the vast panorama of the volcanic wilderness. To the east, where the broad high plain of Saint-Flour and the marshes of the Rioux River lay, to the north, to the region from which he had come, and where he had wandered for days through pitted limestone mountains, to the west, from where the soft wind of morning brought him nothing but the smells of stone and tough grass, finally to the south, where the foothills of the Plon stretched for miles to the dark gorges of the Truyère. Everywhere, in every direction, humanity lay equally remote from him, and a step in any direction would have meant closer proximity to human beings. The compass spun about. It no longer provided orientation. Grenouille was at his goal, and at the same time he was taken captive. As the sun rose, he was still standing on the same spot, his nose held up to the air. With a desperate effort, he tried to get a whiff of the direction from which threatening humanity came, and of the opposite direction to which he could flee still farther. He assumed that in whatever direction he turned, he ought to detect some latent scrap of human odour. But there was nothing. Here there was only peace, olfactory peace, if it can be put that way. Spread all about, as if softly rustling, lay nothing but the drifting, homogeneous odour of dead stones, of grey lichen, and of withered grasses. Nothing else. Grenouille needed a very long time to believe what he was not smelling. He was not prepared for his good luck. His mistrust fought against his good sense for quite a while. He even used his eyes to aid him as the sun rose, and he scanned the horizon for the least sign of human presence, for the roof of a hut, the smoke of a fire, a fence, a bridge, a herd. He held his hands to his ears and listened for a scythe being whetted, for the bark of a dog or the cry of a child. That whole day he stood fast in the blazing heat on the peak of the Plan du Cantal, and waited in vain for the slightest evidence. Only as the sun set did his mistrust gradually fade before an ever-increasing sense of euphoria. He had escaped the abhorrent taint. He was truly completely alone. He was the only human being in the world. He erupted with thundering jubilation. Like a shipwrecked sailor, ecstatically greeting the sight of an inhabited island after weeks of aimless drifting, Grenouille celebrated his arrival at the Mountain of Solitude. He shouted for joy. He cast aside his rucksack, blanket, walking stick, and stamped his feet on the ground, threw his arms to the sky, danced in circles, roared his own name to the four winds, clenched his fists, shaking them triumphantly at the great wide country lying below him and at the setting sun, triumphantly, as if he personally had chased it from the sky. He carried on like a madman until late into the night. 25. He spent the next few days settling in on the mountain, for he had made up his mind that he would not be leaving this blessed region all that soon. First he sniffed around for water, and in a crevasse a little below the top found it running across the rock in a thin film. It was not much, but if he patiently licked at it for an hour, he could quench his daily need for liquids. He also found nourishment in the form of small salamanders and ring snakes. He pinched off their heads, then devoured them whole. He also ate dry lichen and grass and moss berries. Such a diet, although totally unacceptable by bourgeois standards, did not disgust him in the least. In the past weeks and months he had no longer fed himself with food processed by human hands, bread, sausage, cheese, but instead, whenever he felt hungry, had wolfed down anything vaguely edible that had crossed his path. He was anything but a gourmet. He had no use for sensual gratification, unless that gratification consisted of pure, incorporeal odours. He had no use for creature comforts either, and would have been quite content to set up camp on bare stone. But he found something better. Near his watering spot he discovered a natural tunnel leading back into the mountain by many twists and turns, until, after 100 feet or so, it came to an end in a rock slide. The back of the tunnel was so narrow that Grenouille's shoulders touched the rock, and so low that he could walk up only hunched down. But he could sit, and if he curled up, could even lie down. That completely satisfied his requirements for comfort, for the spot had incalculable advantages. At the end of the tunnel it was pitch-black night, even during the day. It was deathly quiet, and the air he breathed was moist, salty, cool. Grenouille could smell at once that no living creature had ever entered the place. As he took possession of it, he was overcome by a sense of something like sacred awe. He carefully spread his horse blanket on the ground as if dressing an altar, and lay down on it. He felt blessedly wonderful. He was lying 150 feet below the earth, inside the loneliest mountain in France, as if in his own grave. Never in his life had he felt so secure, certainly not in his mother's belly. The world could go up in flames out there, but he would not even notice it here. He began to cry softly. He did not know whom to thank for such good fortune. In the days that followed, he went into the open only to lick at his watering spot, quickly to relieve himself of his urine and excrement, and to hunt lizards and snakes. They were easy to bag at night when they retreated under flat stones, or into little holes, where he could trace them with his nose. He climbed back up to the peak a few more times during the first weeks to sniff out the horizon. But soon that had become more a wearisome habit than a necessity, for he had not once scented the least threat. And so he finally gave up these excursions, and was concerned only with getting back into his crypt as quickly as possible, once he had taken care of the most basic chores necessary for simple survival. For here, inside the crypt, was where he truly lived. Which is to say, for well over 20 hours a day, in total darkness, and in total silence, and in total immobility, he sat on his horse blanket at the end of the stony corridor, his back resting on the rock slide, his shoulders wedged between the rocks, and enjoyed himself. We are familiar with people who seek out solitude, penitents, failures, saints, or prophets. They retreat to deserts, preferably, where they live on locusts and honey. Others, however, live in caves or cells on remote islands. Some, more spectacularly, squat in cages mounted high atop poles, swaying in the breeze. They do this to be nearer to God. Their solitude is a self-mortification by which they do penance. They act in the belief that they are living a life pleasing to God. Or they wait months, years, for their solitude to be broken by some divine message that they hope then speedily to broadcast among mankind. Grenouille's case was nothing of the sort. There was not the least notion of God in his head. He was not doing penance, nor waiting for some supernatural inspiration. He had withdrawn solely for his own personal pleasure, only to be near to himself. No longer distracted by anything external, he basked in his own existence, and found it splendid. He lay in his stony crypt like his own corpse, hardly breathing, his heart hardly beating, and yet lived as intensively and dissolutely as ever a rake had lived in the wide world outside. 26. The setting for these debaucheries was, how could it be otherwise, the innermost empire where he had buried the husks of every odour encountered since birth. To enhance the mood, he first conjured up those that were earliest and most remote. The hostile, steaming vapours of Madame Gaillard's bedroom, the bone-dry, leathery bouquet of her hands, the vinegary breath of Father Terrier, the hysterical, hot maternal sweat of Bussy the wet-nurse, the carrion stench of the Cimetière des Innocents, the homicidal odour of his mother. And he wallowed in disgust and loathing, and his hair stood on end at the delicious horror. Sometimes, if this repulsive aperitif did not quite get him into stride, he would allow himself a brief odoriferous detour to Grimal's for a whiff of the stench of raw meaty skins and tanning broths, or he imagined the collective effluvium of 600,000 Parisians in the sultry oppressive heat of late summer. And then, all at once, the pent-up hate would erupt with orgasmic force. That was, after all, the point of the exercise. Like a thunderstorm, he rolled across these odours that had dared offend his patrician nose. He thrashed at them as hail thrashes a grain field. Like a hurricane, he scattered the rabble and drowned them in a grand purifying deluge of distilled water. And how just was his anger, how great his revenge. Oh, what a sublime moment! Grenouille, the little man, quivered with excitement. His body writhed with voluptuous delight, and arched so high that he slammed his head against the roof of the tunnel, only to sink back slowly and lie there lolling in satiation. It really was too pleasant, this volcanic act that extinguished all obnoxious odours. Really too pleasant. This was almost his favourite routine in the whole repertoire of his innermost universal theatre, for it imparted to him the wonderful sense of righteous exhaustion that comes only after truly grand heroic deeds. Now he could rest a while in good conscience. He stretched out, to the extent his body fit within the narrow stony quarters. Deep inside, however, on the cleanly swept mats of his soul, he stretched out comfortably to the fullest and dozed away, letting delicate scents play about his nose. A spicy gust, for instance, as if born here from springtime meadows, a mild May wind wafting through the first green leaves of beech, a sea breeze with the bitterness of salted almonds. It was late afternoon when he arose, something like late afternoon, for naturally there was no afternoon or forenoon, or evening or morning. There was neither light nor darkness, nor were there spring meadows, nor green beech leaves. There were no real things at all in Grenouille's innermost universe, only the odours of things. Which is why the façon de parler speaks of that universe as a landscape, an adequate expression, to be sure, but the only possible one, since our language is of no use when it comes to describing the smellable world. It was, then, late afternoon. That is, a condition and a moment within Grenouille's soul, such as reigns over the south when the siesta is done and the paralysis of midday slowly recedes and life's urge begins again after such constraint. The heat kindled by rage, the enemy of sublime sense, had fled. The pack of demons was annihilated. The fields within him lay soft and burnished beneath the lascivious peace of his awakening, and they waited for the will of their Lord to come upon them. And Grenouille rose up, as noted, and shook the sleep from his limbs. He stood up, the great innermost Grenouille. Like a giant he planted himself, in all his glory and grandeur, splendid to look upon, damn shame that no one saw him, and looked about him, proud and majestic. Yes, this was his empire, the incomparable empire of Grenouille, created and ruled over by him, the incomparable Grenouille, laid waste by him if he so chose, and then raised up again, made boundless by him, and defended with a flaming sword against every intruder. Here there was naught but his will, the will of the great, splendid, incomparable Grenouille. And now that the evil stench of the past had been swept away, he desired that his empire be fragrant. And with mighty strides he passed across the fallow fields, and sowed fragrance of all kinds, wastefully here, sparingly there, in plantations of endless dimension, and in small, intimate parcels, strewing seeds by the fistful, or tucking them in one by one in selected spots. To the farthermost regions of his empire, Grenouille the Great, the frantic gardener, hurried, and soon there was not a cranny left into which he had not thrown a seed of fragrance. And when he saw that it was good, and that the whole earth was saturated with his divine grenouille seeds, then Grenouille the Great let descend a shower of rectified spirit, soft and steady, and everywhere and over all the seed began to germinate and sprout, bringing forth shoots to gladden his heart. On the plantations it rolled in luxurious waves, and in the hidden gardens the stems stood full with sap, the blossoms all but exploded from their buds. Then Grenouille the Great commanded the rain to stop, and it was so, and he sent the gentle sun of his smile upon the land, whereupon, to a bud, the hosts of blossoms unfolded their glory, from one end of his empire unto the other, creating a single rainbowed carpet woven from myriad precious capsules of fragrance. And Grenouille the Great saw that it was good, very, very good, and he caused the wind of his breath to blow across the land. And the blossoms, thus caressed, spilled over with scent, and intermingled their teeming scents into one constantly changing scent, that in all its variety was nevertheless merged into the odour of universal homage to him, Grenouille the Great, the incomparable, the magnificent, who, enthroned upon his gold-scented cloud, sniffed his breath back in again, and the sweet savour of the sacrifice was pleasing unto him. And he deigned to bless his creation several times over, from whom came thanksgiving, with songs of praise and rejoicing, and yet further outpourings of glorious fragrance. Meanwhile evening was come, and the scents spilled over, still and united with the blue of night, to form ever more fantastic airs. A veritable gala of scent awaited, with one gigantic burst of fragrant, diamond-studded fireworks. Grenouille the Great, however, had tired a little, and yawned, and spoke, "Behold, I have done a great thing, and I am well pleased. But as with all the works once finished, it begins to bore me. I shall withdraw, and to crown this strenuous day, I shall allow myself yet one more small delectation in the chambers of my heart." So spoke Grenouille the Great, and while the peasantry of scent danced and celebrated beneath him, he glided with wide-stretched wings down from his golden clouds, across the nocturnal fields of his soul, and home to his heart. 27. Ah, returning home was pleasant. The double role of avenger and creator of worlds was not a little taxing, and then to be celebrated afterwards for hours on end by one's own offspring was not the perfect way to relax either. Weary of the duties of divine creator and official host, Grenouille the Great longed for some small domestic bliss. His heart was a purple castle. It lay in a rock-strewn desert, concealed by dunes, surrounded by a marshy oasis, and set behind stone walls. It could be reached only from the air. It had 1,000 private rooms, and 1,000 underground chambers, and 1,000 elegant salons, among them one with a purple sofa, when Grenouille, no longer Grenouille the Great, but only the quite private Grenouille, or simply dear little Jean-Baptiste, would recover from the labours of the day. The castle's private rooms, however, were shelved from floor to ceiling, and on those shelves were all the odours that Grenouille had collected in the course of his life, several million of them. And in the castle's cellars the best scents of his life were stored in casks. When properly aged, they were drawn off into bottles that lay in miles of damp, cool corridors, and were arranged by vintage and estate. There were so many that they could not all be drunk in a single lifetime. Once dear little Jean-Baptiste had finally returned chez soi, lying on his simple, cosy sofa in his purple salon, his boots finally pulled off, so to speak, he clapped his hands and called his servants, who were invisible, intangible, inaudible, and above all, inodorous, and thus totally imaginary servants, and ordered them to go to the private rooms and get this or that volume from the great library of odours, and to the cellars to fetch something for him to drink. The imaginary servants hurried off, and Grenouille's stomach cramped in tormented expectation. He suddenly felt like a drunkard who is afraid that the shot of brandy he has ordered at the bar will, for some reason or other, be denied him. What if the cellar or the library were suddenly empty? If the wine in the casks had gone sour? Why were they keeping him waiting? Why did they not come? He needed the stuff now. He needed it desperately. He was addicted. He would die on the spot if he did not get it. "Calm yourself, Jean-Baptiste. Calm yourself, my friend. They're coming, they're coming, they're bringing what you crave. The servants are winging their way here with it. They are carrying the Book of Odours on an invisible tray, and in their white-gloved, invisible hands they are carrying those precious bottles. They set them down ever so carefully, they bow, and they disappear. And then, left alone, at last, once again, left alone, Jean-Baptiste reaches for the odours he craves, opens the first bottle, pours a glass full to the rim, puts it to his lips, and drinks. Drinks the glass of cool scent down in one draught, and it is luscious. It is so refreshingly good that dear Jean-Baptiste's eyes fill with tears of bliss, and he immediately pours himself a second glass. A scent from the year 1752, sniffed up in spring, before sunrise on the Pont Royal, his nose directed to the west, from where a light breeze bore the blended odours of sea and forest, and a touch of the tarry smell of the barges tied up at the bank. It was the scent from the end of his first night spent roaming about Paris without Grimal's permission. It was the fresh odour of the approaching day, of the first daybreak that he had ever known in freedom. That odour had been the pledge of freedom. It had been the pledge of a different life. The odour of that morning was for Grenouille the odour of hope. He guarded it carefully, and he drank of it daily. Once he had emptied the second glass, all his nervousness, all his doubt and insecurity fell away from him, and he was filled with glorious contentment. He pressed his back against the soft cushions of his sofa, opened a book, and began to read from his memoirs. He read about the odours of his childhood, of his school days, about the odours of the broad streets and hidden nooks of the city, about human odours. And a pleasant shudder washed over him, for the odours he now called up were indeed those that he despised, that he had exterminated. With sickened interest, Grenouille read from the Book of Revolting Odours, and when his disgust outweighed his interest, he simply slammed the book shut, laid it aside, and picked up another. All the while he drank without pause from his noble scents. After the bottle of hope, he uncorked one from the year 1744, filled with the warm scent of the wood outside Madame Gaillard's house. And after that he drank a bottle of the scent of a summer evening, imbued with perfume and heavy with blossoms, gleaned from the edge of a park in Saint-Germain-des-Prés, dated 1753. He was now scent-logged. His arms and legs grew heavier and heavier as they pressed into the cushions. His mind was wonderfully fogged. But it was not yet the end of his debauch. His eyes could read no more, true. The book had long since fallen from his hand. But he did not want to call an end to the evening without having emptied one last bottle, the most splendid of all. The scent of the girl from the Rue des Marais. He drank it reverently, and he sat upright on the sofa to do so, although that was difficult, and the purple salon whirled and swayed with every move. Like a schoolboy, his knees pressed together, his feet side by side, his left hand resting on his left thigh. That was how little Grenouille drank the most precious scent from the cellars of his heart, glass after glass, and grew sadder and sadder as he drank. He knew that he was drinking too much. He knew that he could not handle so much good scent. And yet he drank till the bottle was empty. He walked along the dark passage from the street into the rear courtyard. He made for the glow of light. The girl was sitting there pitting yellow plums. Far in the distance, the rockets and petards of the fireworks were booming. He put the glass down and sat there for a while yet, several minutes, stiff with sentimentality and guzzling, until the last aftertaste had vanished from his palate. He stared vacantly ahead. His head was suddenly as empty as the bottle. Then he toppled sideways on to the purple sofa, and from one moment to the next sank into a numbed sleep. At the same time, the other Grenouille fell asleep on his horse blanket, and his sleep was just as fathomless as that of the innermost Grenouille, for the Herculean deeds and excesses of the one had more than exhausted the other. They were, after all, one and the same person. When he awoke, however, he did not awaken in the purple salon of his purple castle behind the seven walls, nor upon the vernal fields of scent within his soul, but most decidedly in his stony dungeon at the end of a tunnel, on hard ground, in the dark. And he was nauseated with hunger and thirst, and as chilled and miserable as a drunkard after a night of carousing. He crept on all fours out of his tunnel. Outside, it would be some time of day or another, usually toward the beginning or end of night, but even at midnight the brightness of the starlight pricked his eyes like needles. The air seemed dusty to him, acrid, searing his lungs. The landscape was brittle. He bumped against the stones. And even the most delicate odours came sharp and caustic into a nose unaccustomed to the world. Grenouille the tick had grown as touchy as a hermit crab that has left its shell to wander naked through the sea. He went to his watering spot, licked the moisture from the wall, for an hour, for two. It was pure torture. Time would not end, time in which the real world scorched his skin. He ripped a few scraps of moss from the stones, choked them down, squatted, shitting as he ate. It must all be done quickly, quickly, quickly. And as if he were a hunted creature, a little soft-fleshed animal, and the hawks were already circling in the sky overhead, he ran back to his cave, to the end of the tunnel where his horse blanket was spread. There he was safe at last. He leaned back against the stony debris, stretched out his legs, and waited. He had to hold his body very still, like some vessel about to slosh over from too much motion. Gradually he managed to gain control of his breathing. His excited heart beat more steadily. The pounding of the waves inside him subsided slowly. And suddenly solitude fell across his heart like a dusky reflection. He closed his eyes. The dark doors within him opened, and he entered. The next performance in the theatre of Grenouille's soul was beginning. 28. And so it went, day in, day out, week in, week out, month in, month out. So it went for 7 long years. Meanwhile, war raged in the world outside, a world war. Men fought in Silesia and Saxony, in Hanover and the Low Countries, in Bohemia and Pomerania. The king's troops died in Hesse and Westphalia, on the Balearic Islands, in India, on the Mississippi and in Canada, if they had not already succumbed to typhoid on the journey. The war robbed 1 million people of their lives, France of its colonial empire, and all the warring nations of so much money that they finally decided, with heavy hearts, to end it. One winter during this period, Grenouille almost froze to death, without ever noticing it. For 5 days he lay in his purple salon, and when he awoke in his tunnel, he was so cold he could not move. He closed his eyes again and would have slept himself to death. But then the weather turned around, there was a thaw, and he was saved. Once the snow was so deep that he did not have the strength to burrow down to the lichen. He fed himself on the stiff carcasses of frozen bats. Once a dead raven lay at the mouth of the cave. He ate it. These were the only events in the outside world of which he took notice for 7 years. Otherwise he lived only within his mountain, only within the self-made empire of his soul. And he would have remained there until his death, since he lacked for nothing, if catastrophe had not struck, driving him from his mountain, vomiting him back out into the world. 29. The catastrophe was not an earthquake, nor a forest fire, nor an avalanche, nor a cave-in. It was not an external catastrophe at all, but an internal one, and as such particularly distressing, because it blocked Grenouille's favourite means of escape. It happened in his sleep, or better, in his dreams, or better still, in a dream while he slept in the heart of his fantasies. He lay on his sofa in the purple salon and slept, the empty bottles all about him. He had drunk an enormous amount, with 2 whole bottles of the scent of the red-haired girl for a nightcap. Apparently it had been too much, for his sleep, though deep as death itself, was not dreamless this time, but threaded with ghostly wisps of dreams. These wisps were clearly recognisable as scraps of odours. At first they merely floated in thin threads past Grenouille's nose, but then they grew thicker, more cloud-like. And now it seemed as if he were standing in the middle of a moor from which fog was rising. The fog slowly climbed higher. Soon Grenouille was completely wrapped in fog, saturated with fog, and it seemed he could not get his breath for the foggy vapour. If he did not want to suffocate, he would have to breathe the fog in, and the fog was, as noted, an odour. And Grenouille knew what kind of odour. The fog was his own odour. His, Grenouille's, own body odour was the fog. And the awful thing was that Grenouille, although he knew that this odour was his odour, could not smell it. Virtually drowning in himself, he could not for the life of him smell himself. As this became clear to him, he gave a scream as dreadful and loud as if he were being burned alive. The scream smashed through the walls of the purple salon, through the walls of the castle, and sped away from his heart across the ditches and swamps and deserts, hurtled across the nocturnal landscape of his soul like a firestorm, howled its way out of his mouth, down the winding tunnel, out into the world, and far across the high plains of Saint-Flour, as if the mountain itself were screaming. And Grenouille awoke at his own scream. In waking, he thrashed about as if he had to drive off the odourless fog trying to suffocate him. He was deathly afraid. His whole body shook with the raw fear of death. Had his scream not ripped open the fog, he would have drowned in himself, a gruesome death. He shuddered as he recalled it. And as he sat there shivering and trying to gather his confused, terrified thoughts, he knew one thing for sure. He would change his life, if only because he did not want to dream such a frightening dream a second time. He would not survive it a second time. He threw his horse blanket over his shoulders and crept out into the open. It was already morning outside, a late February morning. The sun was shining. The earth smelled of moist stones, moss, and water. On the wind there already lay a light bouquet of anemones. He squatted on the ground before his cave. The sunlight warmed him. He breathed in the fresh air. Whenever he thought of the fog that he had escaped, a shudder would pass over him. And he shuddered, too, from the pleasure of the warmth he felt on his back. It was good, really, that this external world still existed, if only as a place of refuge. Nor could he bear the awful thought of how it would have been not to find a world at the entrance to the tunnel. No light, no odour, no nothing. Only that ghastly fog, inside, outside, everywhere. Gradually the shock subsided. Gradually the grip of anxiety loosened, and Grenouille began to feel safer. Toward noon he was his old, cold-blooded self. He laid the index and middle fingers of his left hand under his nose, and breathed along the backs of his fingers. He smelled the moist spring air, spiced with anemones. He did not smell anything of his fingers. He turned his hand over and sniffed at the palm. He sensed the warmth of his hand, but smelled nothing. Then he rolled up the ragged sleeve of his shirt, buried his nose in the crook of his elbow. He knew that this was the spot where all humans smell like themselves. But he could smell nothing. He could not smell anything in his armpits, nor on his feet, not around his genitals when he bent down to them as far as he possibly could. It was grotesque. He, Grenouille, who could smell other people miles away, was incapable of smelling his own genitals not a hand span away. Nevertheless, he did not panic, but considered it all coolly, and spoke to himself as follows. It is not that I do not smell, for everything smells. It is, rather, that I cannot smell that I smell, because I have smelled myself day in, day out since my birth, and my nose is therefore dulled against my own smell. If I could separate my own smell, or at least a part of it, from me, and then return to it after being weaned from it for a while, then I would most certainly be able to smell it, and therefore me. He laid the horse blanket aside and took off his clothes, or at least what remained of them. Rags and tatters were what he took off. For 7 years he had not removed them from his body. They had to be fully saturated with his own odour. He tossed them into a pile at the cave entrance and walked away. Then, for the first time in 7 years, he once again climbed to the top of the mountain. There he stood on the same spot where he had stood on the day of his arrival, held his nose to the west, and let the wind whistle around his naked body. His intention was thoroughly to air himself, to be pumped so full of the west wind, and that meant with the odour of the sea and wet meadows, that this odour would counterbalance his own body odour, creating a gradient of odours between himself and his clothes, which he would then be in a position to smell. And to prevent his nose from taking in the least bit of his own odour, he bent his body forward, stretching his neck out as far as he could against the wind, with his arms stretched behind him. He looked like a swimmer just before he dives into the water. He held this totally ridiculous pose for several hours, and even by such pale sunlight, his skin, maggot-white from lack of sun, was turned a lobster red. Toward evening he climbed back down to the cave. From far off he could see his clothes lying in a pile. The last few yards he held his nose closed, and opened it again only when he had lowered it right down onto the pile. He made the sniffing test he had learned from Baldini, snatching up the air and then letting it out again in spurts. And to catch the odour, he used both hands to form a bell around his clothes, with his nose stuck into it as the clapper. He did everything possible to extract his own odour from the clothes. But there was no odour in them. It was most definitely not there. There were 1,000 other odours, the odour of stone, sand, moss, resin, raven's blood. Even the odour of the sausage that he had bought years before near Sully was clearly perceptible. Those clothes contained an olfactory diary of the last 7, 8 years. Only one odour was not there. His own odour, the odour of the person who had worn them continuously all that time. And now he began to be truly alarmed. The sun had set. He was standing naked at the entrance to the tunnel, where he had lived in darkness for 7 years. The wind blew cold, and he was freezing, but he did not notice that he was freezing, for within him was a counterfrost, fear. It was not the same fear that he had felt in his dream, the ghastly fear of suffocating on himself, which he had had to shake off and flee, whatever the cost. What he now felt was the fear of not knowing much of anything about himself. It was the opposite pole of that other fear. He could not flee it, but had to move toward it. He had to know for certain, even if that knowledge proved too terrible, whether he had an odour or not, and he had to know now, at once. He went back into the tunnel. Within a few yards he was fully engulfed in darkness, but he found his way as if by brightest daylight. He had gone down this path many thousands of times, knew every step and every turn, could smell every low-hanging jut of rock and every tiny protruding stone. It was not hard to find the way. What was hard was fighting back the memory of the claustrophobic dream, rising higher and higher within him like a flood tide with every step he took. But he was brave. That is to say, he fought the fear of knowing with the fear of not knowing, and he won the battle because he knew he had no choice. When he had reached the end of the tunnel, there where the rock slide slanted upwards, both fears fell away from him. He felt calm, his mind was quite clear, and his nose sharp as a scalpel. He squatted down, laid his hands over his eyes, and smelled. Here, on this spot, in this remote, stony grave, he had lain for 7 years. There must be some smell of him here, if anywhere in this world. He breathed slowly. He analysed exactly. He allowed himself time to come to a judgment. He squatted there for a quarter of an hour. His memory was infallible, and he knew precisely how this spot had smelled 7 years before. Stony and moist, salty, cool, and so pure that no living creature, man or beast, could ever have entered the place, which was exactly how it smelled now. He continued to squat there for a while, quite calm, simply nodding his head gently. Then he turned around and walked, at first hunched down, but when the height of the tunnel allowed it, erect, out into the open air. Outside he pulled on his rags, his shoes had rotted off him years before, threw the horse blanket over his shoulders, and that same night left the Plan du Cantal, heading south. 30. He looked awful. His hair reached down to the hollows of his knees, his scraggly beard to his navel. His nails were like talons, and the skin on his arms and legs, where the rags no longer covered his body, was peeling off in shreds. The first people he met, farmers in a field near the town of Pierrefort, ran off screaming at the sight of him. But in the town itself he caused a sensation. By the hundreds people came running to gape at him. Many of them believed he was an escaped galley slave. Others said he was not really a human being, but some mixture of man and bear, some kind of forest creature. One fellow, who had been to sea, claimed that he looked like a member of a wild Indian tribe in Cayenne, which lay on the other side of the great ocean. They led him before the mayor. There, to the astonishment of the assembly, he produced his journeyman's papers, opened his mouth, and related in a few gabbled but sufficiently comprehensible words, for these were the first words that he had uttered in 7 years, how he had been attacked by robbers, dragged off, and held captive in a cave for 7 years. He had seen neither daylight nor another human being during that time, had been fed by an invisible hand that let down a basket in the dark, and finally set free by a ladder, without his ever knowing why, and without ever having seen his captors or his rescuer. He had thought this story up, since it seemed to him more believable than the truth. And so it was, for similar attacks by robbers occurred not infrequently in the mountains of the Auvergne and Languedoc, and in the Cévennes. At least the mayor recorded it all without protest, and passed his report on to the Marquis de la Taillade Espinasse, liege lord of the town and member of the Parliament in Toulouse. At the age of 40, the Marquis had turned his back on life at the court of Versailles and retired to his estates, where he lived for science alone. From his pen had come an important work concerning dynamic political economy. In it he had proposed the abolition of all taxes on real estate and agricultural products, as well as the introduction of an upside-down progressive income tax, which would hit the poorest citizens the hardest, and so force them to a more vigorous development of their economic activities. Encouraged by the success of his little book, he offered a tract on the raising of boys and girls between the ages of 5 and 10. Then he turned to experimental agriculture. By spreading the semen of bulls over various grasses, he attempted to produce a milk-yielding animal-vegetable hybrid, a sort of udder flower. After initial successes that enabled him to produce a cheese from his milk grass, described by the Academy of Sciences of Lyon as tasting of goat, though slightly bitter, he had to abandon his experiments because of the enormous cost of spewing bull semen by the hundreds of quarts across his fields. In any case, his concern with matters agrobiological had awakened his interest not only in the ploughed clod, so to speak,